it's surprising to see, you know, in a state that has so many problems, for the governor to say she doesn't want to utilize the money to fix them.
The governor rejects part of the state's federal stimulus money. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 19th of March. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the superintendent of Alaska's largest school district reacts to the news.
It's outrage. I just can't. Yeah, I can't believe it.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
Governor Sarah Palin today followed through on hints she has made in the past that the federal stimulus package is too restrictive on future state fiscal action. She is producing legislation that would reject nearly half the money the state has been offered. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Governor Palin says she plans to accept $515 million of the estimated $930 million to which the state is entitled. She says in making that decision, she asked whether the federal government would end up making decisions that Alaskans should make. She questioned whether the money would stimulate the economy and create jobs.
Where government has grown and interferes at unprecedented levels, the tax burden having to increase to keep up with these levels, with no true economic stimulus that we see, we can't accept the bait. In that case, those strings attached lead us toward dependence and not opportunity and prosperity.
Palin says she anticipates one hot topic among Alaskans will be her rejection of $170 million federal dollars destined for direct distribution to schools, including improvements to Title I schools for children of low-income families and further support for children with special needs. Also money for supplemental nutrition and immunization programs, $17 million for employment services and vocational rehabilitation, and $7 million for public safety. She will accept $20 million for stabilization money for education, $70 million for water and sewer projects, and $40 million for housing projects. Nearly half the money accepted goes to a research vessel for the university. House Finance Chair Mike Hawker said he agrees some projects would become a problem for the state in the future. But he says, particularly on the education money, he did not see reasons for turning it down. Hawker says the governor's decision on acceptance and rejection of the money will get a close evaluation. But legislators have already drafted the necessary resolution to accept the money themselves if necessary.
There is no doubt in my mind we are going to make certain that the state protects its rights to receive all stimulus funding. We may have to pass our own resolution to do that, but we're clearly going to protect our right to receive all the funding and continue to evaluate and find out where we may and may not agree with the governor on what's good for the state.
Republicans are divided on the decision, however. Senate Minority Leader Gene Theriault says he's interested in seeing details of the plan, and he trusts that the governor will work cooperatively with members to avoid future fiscal problems.
I appreciate the fact that the state agencies have gone through at this point to clearly identify as best they can those things that are, you know, shovel-ready, create jobs, fix infrastructure, but don't necessarily obligate us programmatically to do certain things a year and a half or 2 years from now.
Democrat Mike Dugan says the governor's fear that the state would commit to future growth in government is not correct. He says future governors and legislators will make decisions in the future based on those future needs.
The legislature and the governor together can do whatever we want. You know, we're not signing any documents that commit us beyond the term of the financing that they're offering.
At Anchorage's Les Guerra said he expected the governor to give a plan to use the federal monies for economic growth and to curtail unemployment. But a lot of good projects were taken off the table.
There are Republican and Democratic governors across the country salivating at announcements like this because they want the money to stem their unemployment growth. And it's surprising to see, you know, in a state that has so many problems, for the governor to say she doesn't want to utilize the money to fix them.
The legislation supporting the governor's decision on the federal money has been prepared, and lawmakers are expected to take it up as soon as possible. A resolution to override the governor's decision must be voted on by April 3rd. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Even if the legislature does vote to apply for the money, overriding the governor's decision, it's not clear whether the state will ultimately be able to accept the funding. The federal stimulus bill includes a clause allowing state legislatures to request money rejected by a governor. But a nonpartisan congressional report released yesterday says the law is vague on the details that would make sure the funding would end up in the state. Larry Persily, a legislative aide for Anchorage Republican Mike Hawker, has reviewed the legal opinion. He says it could become a real problem.
What if a legislature says, we want this money, but the governor or the administration in that state says, well, we're not going to make the application, we're not going to do the paperwork, we're not going to fill out the forms, we're not going to complete the certification. There's nothing in the Stimulus Act that demands, that requires, that mandates a governor cooperate with the legislature.
Persily says the best scenario would be for lawmakers, the public, and the governor to be able to come to an agreement on what funding to accept. But he says that process could drag out for a while.
If the legislature wants funds and the governor doesn't, there's nothing in federal law that overrides the separation of powers and the governor's authority, or if the governor vetoes funds that the legislature wants, then it takes a three-quarter supermajority of the legislature to override the veto. So it could get very messy, very ugly, and very illegal and very complicated.
Senator Mark Begich reacted with disappointment today to the governor's decision to reject stimulus money. Alaska's Democratic senator said outside the Senate chambers today that it's still unclear how much power the legislature has to accept the money, but if it's in danger of losing it, he hopes to remedy that in Congress.
I think what we will do here, if there is a supportive legislative body that says we would like this money and it's strong support for it for these purposes, then if there is something that we have to do back here to make sure that money is expended, we're going to do that. I'm going to do it.
Alaska is one of about six states where governors are threatening to reject stimulus money. Begich was involved in getting language through the Senate that attempts to give legislatures the ability to take stimulus funds that governors reject. He says he recognizes Governor Palin's cautious concern and her focus on infrastructure money, but Begich emphasizes the funds are designed to be temporary and short-term in order to stimulate the economy. He says some of Palin's rejections don't line up with requests she's made to the delegation.
You know, here's one example, the public safety money she doesn't want to take. But one of her 10 legislative requests through her office here is for money for village police officers. Well, that money could be used for village police officers, but she's made an earmark request for that same thing. So I don't really understand that.
Begich says when Governor Palin called him today to tell him her decision, it sounded to him like she would not override the legislature if it wants the money. The governor's rejection of $170 million in education funding caught Anchorage School Superintendent Carol Como completely by surprise. An hour later, when KSKA's Len Anderson talked to her, the superintendent was still dumbfounded by Palin's decision.
It's a huge loss. It's just so unfair. It's just so unfair.
Superintendent Como was calling Anchorage school board members to tell them that the governor's morning announcement had waylaid district plans for the stimulus funding.
The board and I have talked a lot about trying to add preschools in our Title I schools that we think we can make a difference. And if the money goes away in 2 years, then we could redirect some of our Title I money to keep preschools and not do something else.
Title I schools are those largely comprised of economically disadvantaged students. The schools and students receive special attention within the federal No Child Left Behind Act. Anchorage has about two dozen Title I schools. According to a 2008 report, it also has some 4,600 students with disabilities. The district's special needs programs were also stimulus money targets. Teacher improvement and incentive programs, as well as certified and non-certified hires, were all included in the Anchorage School District proposal. Como says advanced federal reports indicated that Anchorage schools would have qualified for about $12.5 million in Title I monies and another $13 million in IDEA funding over a 2-year period. IDEA stands for Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. The Anchorage superintendent hopes to find a way the district can still receive the stimulus money, possibly through legislative action or pressure. Como suspects Palin's funding rejection stems from causes lying beyond Alaska's boundaries.
To turn down that amount of money in a time when our state is having serious financial difficulties, this 2 years of federal infusion for all the kids in the state who both qualify for special education and also Title I services, I think is a disservice to our state. And I don't think she's thinking totally about the state's needs, but a more national picture.
Como said as soon as she contacted all the board members, she wanted to talk to the Commissioner of Education and Early Childhood Development, Larry Ledoux, and then the governor. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a ghost story from Alaska's oldest building.
She went to the door, opened it, looked out, and there was no one there. And she looked all over the building, and there was no one in the building. And after that, she never worked here at night.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the University of Alaska College Savings Plan, helping you reach educational savings goals. Save in Alaska, study anywhere. Information at 1-888-4-ALASKA. This message sponsored by the UA College Savings Plan. And by the Alaska State Elks Lodges, providing children the opportunity to attend summer camp and other age-appropriate activities. Information at alaskastateelks.org.
For the second time, the U.S. Senate has approved a hefty public lands package that includes a land swap in the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge. It could increase the size of the Eisenbeck and Alaska Peninsula Wildlife Refuges by more than 61,000 acres in exchange for 206 acres sought by the community of King Cove. They want it to build a gravel road through designated wilderness to reach the all-weather airport in Cold Bay. Della Trumbull with the King Cove Corporation says a hovercraft the community currently uses doesn't work when the weather is bad.
I think what it means for us is the ability to have safe access between the two communities in the event of health, medevacs, and the other piece of it is just the ability to have safe access, period, because it's many people that live here are afraid to travel between the two communities.
The bill returned to the Senate today for a second round. It passed 2 months ago, but failed in the House last week by just a couple of votes. Trumbull says they're optimistic it will go through this time. All three members of Alaska's congressional delegation support the massive lands package, which is a collection of more than 160 public lands bills that affect all 50 states. Senator Lisa Murkowski spoke on the floor just before it passed.
One of the measures in this public lands package that relates to my state is an issue we've been working on, a land exchange, for almost two decades now in an effort to try to find resolve. And through a great deal of compromise with the agencies, with public interest groups, with policymakers, we have a legislation that we believe works.
But environmentalists like Nicole Whittington Evans with the Alaska Office of the Wilderness Society say the Eisenbeck Refuge should be off limits to a road.
The resource values of Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge are internationally important, and a road has no place through the protected wilderness lands of Eisenbeck. This is a globally significant wetlands and wilderness area.
Whittington Evans says the King Cove community should be able to use the hovercraft they currently have to reach the Cold Bay Airport, which she believes is faster and safer than passage by road. The House should take up the bill as soon as next week. They only need a simple majority to pass it, which is expected. Even if the big lands package is signed into law, the King Cove Road is far from a sure thing. Today's bill says the Interior Secretary can decide whether the exchange is a good idea and requires an environmental impact statement on how a road would impact the refuge. Whittington Evans says environmentalists will continue to fight it. The action is picking up in Nome at the finish line of the Iditarod. Willow musher Ramey Smith recorded another top 10 finish, the sixth of his Iditarod career, when he claimed ninth place this morning. He was one of only a few mushers who moved up in the standings along the coast, passing seven teams between Unalakleet and Koyuk to slip into the top 10. Smith credits his 12-year-old leader, Babe, the winner of last year's Top Lead Dog Award, with getting the team to Nome.
She pulled my team across the sound there into Koyuk when it was storming and passed up all the other teams that couldn't go and the leaders wouldn't go and they couldn't find the markers and she could. She's been here 10 times and I wouldn't be here in this place without her.
Jeff King was one of the mushers that chose to avoid a windstorm by hunkering down at Shaktuluk earlier this week. After crossing the finish line in 12th place earlier today, King explained that he didn't venture out in the wind because he wasn't sure any of his relatively young lead dogs could handle it.
There have been a few disasters over the years with a bad storm, and if you're the one in the front, you got to make the decision about whether or not you want to go out there, and are you prepared to take the very best care of your team, and I chose to sit that one out. So I have no huge regrets. I'm very happy for the way the race played out. Lance sure seems to have had a magic carpet ride.
This is only the fourth time King has missed the top 10 in a career spanning 20 Iditarods. The Iditarod Trail Committee is completing its first year of offering paid subscribers a GPS tracking system on the internet. Every musher in the field was required to carry a GPS transponder this year. Satellite-based tracking is primarily intended to make the race more exciting for fans. APRN's trail reporter Tim Bodoni has the story.
The GPS tracking technology comes from Traverse City, Michigan-based company Ion Earth. The company developed its tracking system for use in the oil and gas industry and then expanded into long-distance endurance sports like sailboat racing and off-road auto racing. Ion Earth co-owner Jerry Miller has been hopping along the Iditarod Trail to help maintain and monitor the GPS system. He says that his relationship with Iditarod began with a cold call several years ago, and he found that Iditarod was searching for a GPS tracking feature that would handle the unique challenges of the race.
So we actually wound up developing custom hardware just for the Iditarod because there were needs that were required by the Iditarod that didn't exist in our other racing applications. The duration of the race, the cold temperatures, the vibration and durability that the units had to have.
The battery that powers each GPS unit is specially designed for use in extreme cold temperatures, all the way down to 100 below zero Fahrenheit.
Now, our electronics can't operate at that level, but the batteries can operate there. And what happens with batteries is they just lose capacity. And what these batteries do, they lose capacity at a slower rate with temperature.
The use of GPS navigation devices by mushers on the trail has been and continues to be against the rules. Mushers are also forbidden from looking at the new online tracking system to gauge the progress of their fellow competitors. But even if mushers don't sneak a peek at a computer at a checkpoint, they frequently receive secondhand information derived from the GPS tracker from friends and spectators. By removing the mystery of where mushers are at a given moment, some argue that the addition of GPS tracking presents a threat to the purity or fairness of the race. Iditarod race marshal Mark Nordman disagrees and foresees a time when the mushers will also be allowed to use the GPS tracker.
If you want to waste your time trying to check out where your competitors are instead of trying to race your own dogs, go ahead. I don't think it would ever affect the competition, because these guys know well, especially the professional mushers know, that the only reason they get to know them in a good time is them watching their team and their team only.
Third place finisher John Baker saw the GPS tracker for the first time at the Nome Iditarod headquarters on Thursday. His first reaction was to think about how bizarre and comical it would be to see mushers using the tracker at checkpoints.
Everybody would just be having so much fun playing like a Nintendo game. They'd just be sitting around playing on the computer instead of racing. You know, I just picture guys that should be out running their dogs deciding, oh, I'm going to stay in here and see what these guys are doing.
Another plus of the GPS tracker, according to Nordman, is that it adds another level of safety to the race. When mushers are overdue at checkpoints, the GPS tracker helps race officials decide if a search and rescue mission should be launched.
Because I can tell if somebody's in trouble if they haven't moved for so long. It allows our Air Force to know where people are. Its safety factor, it's been great for me as an official.
The feedback about the GPS tracker has been overwhelmingly positive, according to Nordman, especially from fans. And Baker thinks that if it's popular with the fans, then it's good for the race.
I guess we probably all knew it was coming and it was fine with us, you know. They don't weigh anything, and it obviously helps the people that want to watch the race, so of course if there's some way we could help, we have to.
And perhaps there are no greater fans of the GPS tracker than the families of Iditarod mushers, who don't have to worry as much about what's happening to their loved ones on the trail. Gina Lidner, wife of 11th place finisher Sonny Lidner, says that the tracker definitely improved her mental state during this Iditarod compared to Iditarod's past.
When you're ready to go to bed at night, if you see that they're moving or where the race plan says they should be, you can actually go to sleep. So I think it's great.
Eye on Earth wants to provide GPS tracking for other sled dog races, and company co-owner Jerry Miller predicts that a few more races will be using the technology as soon as next year. In Nome, this is Tim Bodoni.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
Defenders of Wildlife is asking the court to stop Fish and Game from shooting wolves from helicopters in the eastern interior. Defenders Alaska Representative Wade Willis says the state acted illegally when it began shooting wolves from a helicopter in the country between the Yukon River and Alaska Highway over the weekend. Willis says recent Game Board regulatory changes to accommodate helicopter use in predator control has not gone into effect yet.
They did not take emergency actions to make these regulatory changes immediately. So it's our opinion that the Board of Game did not authorize the ADF&G to be conducting aerial predator control in this game management unit at this time.
Willis says Defenders of Wildlife wants a temporary injunction to stop the kill so that the program can be vetted by the Game Board and the public. Game Board Chairman Cliff Judkins says the board's recent regulatory actions simply reaffirm board support for authority the Commissioner of Fish and Game already has.
Without the action of the board, the department has the authority to go out with helicopters and remove wolves in areas where there's the population out of line. It's already in the law, so all we were doing was clarifying what was already there.
Fish and Game Regional Supervisor David James says he got the control plan okayed by the Commissioner of Fish and Game before moving ahead last week.
The department's current effort in the Upper Yukon Tanana Predator Control came from a request from staff when we pointed out that our objectives had been, we'd been unsuccessful meeting our objectives during the past 3 years through the standard a permit issuing process to public, to private shooters to go remove the wolves. And we received a delegation authority from the commissioner's office to proceed. And on that basis, we initiated the program last Saturday.
James says timing was tight because perfect conditions for tracking wolves presented a rare opportunity for Fish and Game to jumpstart predator control in an area where the wolf harvest has been left up to permitted volunteers and kill numbers have been below department objectives. Any building that's 200 years old almost certainly has ghost stories associated with it, and Kodiak's Erskine House, the oldest building in Alaska, is no exception. KMXT's Jay Barrett has more.
Originally built by the Russian-American company as a warehouse, the Erskine House, also known as the Russian-American Magazine, now houses the Kodiak Historical Society's Baranov Museum. It may also be the home to the ghost of a man murdered in its kitchen. Pat Holmes, president of the Kodiak Historical Society, has long heard the stories of the ghost.
Some time ago, I don't recall exactly the date, there was we had a murder in the kitchen. Or not we, but a murder occurred. And Aleut Hunter had someone, he had been convinced that his wife, the cook, was having an affair with someone. And he looked in the window and saw the person sitting at the table for dinner with and he just shot him. And evidently there was quite a wild chase, and he was never found, although they found some remains that they thought it might have been him, but they didn't know. And, of course, the person that he suspected died. And so since then, a lot of the old-timers in Kodiak think that there's a ghost in the building.
Yes. This was in 1890-something, long time ago.
That's Marion Johnson, who managed the Baranoff Museum for over 25 years.
McIntyre was a Scottish gentleman that was the manager for the company that bought the furs, and he was sitting having lunch in the kitchen with an Englishman. I believe his name was Alan Seaton, who wrote a book about the event, and a Mr. Walk, who was a school teacher and also did maps, and there was a fourth man that I don't remember, but a disgruntled person on the outside shot, killed McIntyre, and wounded Mr. Walk's jaw. So Mr. Walk had to be taken to San Francisco for medical attention on a sailing ship that was at the dock.
Holmes says many unexplained events have occurred over the past 100 years, supporting the theory that McIntyre's ghost may still restlessly roam the halls of the old building.
A cousin of mine, she had been a volunteer here with Eunice Nethis and was working way late at night. She's up here working in the office, and then she heard the front door go like it had opened and closed, and probably only the wind. And then she heard the stomp, stomp, creak, like someone came up the stairs. And she was so excited that her husband was home early in the middle of the week, called out, "Is that you, Wayne? Wayne, honey?" And no one answered. So she went to the door, opened it, looked out, and there was no one there. And she looked all over the building, and there was no one in the building. And after that, she never worked here at night.
Despite the decades she spent in the Erskine House, Johnson hasn't encountered McIntyre, but she too knows of folks who refuse to work there alone at night.
Well, I never was afraid of ghosts. I always kind of didn't. They didn't bother me. But I worked with a lady who was very afraid of ghosts and would not work here alone. And Eunice would speak about sometimes there was a ghost upstairs. But I think it's just a creaky wooden building. It might be fun to conjure up something, but no, we won't do that.
Holmes says despite all the remodeling that's been done on the Erskine House over the winter, none of the construction workers uncovered traces of McIntyre's ghost, but then again, they weren't working alone on dark and stormy nights. In Kodiak, I'm Jay Barrett.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Len Anderson in Anchorage, Tim Bodoni in Nome, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Jay Barrett in Kodiak. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP. Giving back to the community is a priority because so many at BP call Alaska home. The Association of Alaska School Boards. Their mission is to advocate for children and youth by assisting school boards to provide quality public education, supporting student achievement and local governance. Information at aasb.org.
And by
the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state. Learn more at rasmussen.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.